Hello there, and welcome back to Peace in Their Time, episode 168. Speak softly and carry a big industrial sector. If you've listened to this most recent mini-series covering the first five-year plan and the Soviet Union all the way through, you might have noticed that the story is an insular one. Not much interaction with outside powers, no conferences or feuds of note, while the very fabric of Soviet society was transformed. And if you've listened all the way through, you don't need much of an explanation as to why that was. The stories of the industrial and agricultural revolutions within the USSR were so gigantic, dare I say cataclysmic, in nature, that it does greatly overshadow foreign relations in the period. And while I won't go so far as to say that diplomatic maneuverings really compared to domestic events that I've been covering, they were still of importance and were affected by the course of the first five-year plan. That isn't to say that the USSR's global position changed all that much from the decade prior. They would continuously be a pariah nation, a country devoted to toppling the economic system that held sway everywhere else in the world. The effects of both the Great Depression and the five-year plan did, however, change the calculations of the world's powers. During the 1920s, the Soviet Union was a nation ruined by civil war, largely deindustrialized compared to the limited extent it was industrialized in the first place, focused on resource extraction and, thanks to the NEP, apparently dabbling in market economics. Thanks to its economic backwardness, the Red Army was seen as a poorly equipped mass of infantry, and the run-down national infrastructure was in no shape to properly deploy said masses of simple infantry. There might have been potential for the USSR to become a player as the Tsar's empire had once been, but it would likely take decades before that occurred. Well, the end of the 20s kind of changed all that. Thanks to the Great Depression, almost in an instant, the wealthy nations of the world were laid low and reduced almost to beggary, their own ability to flex on the world stage badly curtailed by domestic realities. And then, thanks to the five-year plan, as well as the follow-up second plan that'll come up in the next miniseries on the Soviets, the USSR's industrial base changed, and not just over decades, but in years. From a historical and even immediate perspective from observers at the time, it was basically overnight. The industrial transformation and general modernization of vast swaths of the country brought the Soviets uncomfortably close to parity with the Western powers. While it was a small example, the Red Army's quick mobilization and deployment in remote Manchuria at the end of 1929 gave the Japanese pause as they realized that the Reds were far more capable than they had expected, and that was before the industrialization drives were really underway. And when Stalin made his speech in February 1931, demanding that the country catch up to the West to avoid being exploited, he didn't just mean the danger was getting stuck being a resource colony that just so happened to have a communist government. There was a clear and active threat. People were out there in the world that would actively come for them. They had to get going, since they had jettisoned free market experimentation and committed to crash course industrialization. The West was not going to be blind to their growing capabilities. It was not enough to partially industrialize. The full potential of the Union had to be unlocked in order to build a fortress against capitalist attack. And while in retrospect the idea of a Western crusade against communism back in those days seems far-fetched, it was a painful fear of the Soviet leadership that had lived through Western interventions during the Civil War. Paranoia over capitalist wreckers was not just the domain of Stalin. Most of the leadership assumed that active schemes were constantly being hatched against them. And if the West ever did attack the Union, they felt sure that their domestic puppets would do everything they could to undermine the Soviet state. A capitalist fifth column, effectively. That's why, despite the fact that the fear-mongering and show trials stemming from war scares and domestic wreckers might seem cynical, and, well, they were, but their extent was a result of genuine fear among the leadership. Were all the engineers from the Shakti trial genuinely guilty in the eyes of Stalin and his subordinates? Even if you don't believe their insistent affirmations as to the guilt of the accused, they did believe that there was a plot somewhere. The five-year plan and the mechanisms of control built to implement it was the vehicle to ensure a little security, that if a stable industrial base could be created, then the Union's enemies would think twice before embarking on, you know, a little adventurism. For the purposes of the first five-year plan and Soviet diplomacy, the Great Depression could not have come at a better time. Just as the plan was really starting to pick up some steam at the end of the decade, the entire bottom of the global economy fell out. Think about all the chaos, disruption, and misery going on during this period. I covered it at the start of the season. The rest of the world was kind of having the inverse experience to the USSR, as their economies were shrinking catastrophically. That being said, the no-breaks industrialization basically left the USSR mostly defenseless. The golden opportunity to act upon the fears of the Soviet leadership was in those first few years of the 30s, when everybody in the USSR was just hanging on by a thread. But the Depression headed that problem off by crippling everybody else. Now, it did create some diplomatic challenges at the same time. The USSR needed to buy machinery from abroad for their new factories, and to do that, they needed foreign currency. And as I mentioned, they were a resource extractor nation at that point, so that meant exporting minerals and agricultural goods. Unfortunately, the Depression kind of crashed the prices on those materials. People weren't buying manufactured goods and food because they had no money, ergo, nobody was buying input resources for those consumer products. That was a big problem, but the Soviets opted to go the brutalist course and just demand higher levels of resource extraction domestically so that they could dump ever more goods onto the market to make up for the shortfall in prices. As you are well aware by this point, this was especially destructive when it came to grain exports. Not only did it make the famines during 1932 and 33 all the worse, it also drove down global prices so badly that nations where grain was either the bedrock of their economy, like in many nations of Central Europe, or at least a big part of their agricultural sector, like in the US and Canada, that farmers in those places were undercut constantly by Soviet exports. And while it wasn't as pronounced, Soviet exports of minerals like coal and iron were also increased, putting the hurt on nations that themselves relied on exporting those resources. This dumping of goods resulted in nations the world over throwing up tariffs on imports from the USSR, which strengthened the protectionist tendencies already in motion during the Depression, cutting nations off from each other economically, while also limiting the amount of foreign currency the Soviets could get a hold of. It was rather annoying to Stalin, as he had intended to make nice with the rest of the world through buying their manufactured goods. Sure, they'd dump a load of cheap resources on foreign markets, but the Soviets would make up for it by basically spending the money they made in Western markets. The anti-communist bent of Western leaders was such, though, that they were not willing to consider that kind of exchange. Plus, farmers in North America and downtrodden coal miners in the UK probably weren't eager to be the sacrifices offered up in such an arrangement. The Commissar of Foreign Affairs, Maxim Litvinov, tried to argue before the League of Nations in 1931 that nations should not discriminate against each other on matters of trade based on domestic policies. The other nations really did not go for that line of thinking. Despite the limitations to how much foreign currency could be earned and therefore how much equipment could be purchased, the successes of the five-year plan created a new energy, not just in the Soviet Union, but the entire world. The industrial advances were heralded in the foreign press, and stood in stark contrast to the crumbling industrial empires of the West. It seemed that as the capitalists were entering into a period of potentially terminal crisis, while the lone bastion of communism was enjoying a miraculous renaissance, leftists the world over were exhilarated with the news coming out of Moscow. To be sure, this was all carefully managed news, and foreign guests were kept to extremely guided tours of the new facilities being built. And don't get me started on how the collectivization efforts were reported, as word about all the starving and the violence was not allowed to make it onto the official bulletins. That being said, what was happening was so vast in scope that word got out anyway. Even still, it was touted as a never-before-seen achievement. A backwards, conservative agricultural sector was not only being modernized, it was being done while its capitalist underpinnings were being ripped out. Not many who were privy to the full details of collectivization would probably think of it positively, but it demonstrated that such a thing could be done. The achievements also created a new sense of confidence. During the 20s, the Soviet leadership was deathly afraid of fighting a modernized great power. By the start of 1930, that had changed drastically. And even before many of the industrial expansions had borne metaphorical fruit, they were starting to act like players on the world stage. Basically, the leadership was confident things would go great, and started acting like the work had already been completed. Which was not a good thing, as at the start of 1930, the setbacks of the first five-year plan had not yet sunk in and would quickly undermine that confidence. When the OGPU managed to lift a prominent white faction émigré leader off the streets of Paris in January and spirit him back to Russia, an international scandal ensued. But instead of meekly deflecting blame and attention over the incident, Moscow openly threw down the gauntlet to the French government and asked if they really wanted to cut ties over a bunch of exiles. A second international incident a month thereafter saw German counterfeiters specializing in rubles get let off with a slap on the wrist in the German courts, prompting the Soviets to demand action from Berlin. The diplomatic flexing proved to be premature, as the disasters of collectivization and the missed goals in the industrial sector started to sink in later in 1930, and after that, state attention had to remain fixed inward, with the entire nation mobilized to meet their quotas. After only a few months of boldness on the world stage, the Soviets quieted down and devoted themselves back to the hard work at home. Now, these seem like minor footnotes, and in the grand scheme of things, they definitely were, but they did, however, alert the Western powers to what diplomacy with the Soviets might look like on a more equal footing, and they did not like it one bit. The French ambassador in Moscow went into a panic over the increased tensions in early 1930 and convinced both his superiors and his Polish counterparts that the Red Army would likely march on Romania soon, so as to regain the Bessarabia province lost in the aftermath of World War I. The Romanians started deploying troops to their east, and just as the first collectivization drive was ending in retreat, the Red Army brass started warning that a shooting war might pop off, and that would mean the Poles would join in, and well, from there, nobody could predict how big of a fight it could turn into. The chaos during the depths of the first five-year plan was such that the Red Army was virtually paralyzed, and given the danger, this also convinced the Soviets to quiet down going into the second half of 1930. While this particular episode didn't result in anything of note, it did reveal to the Soviets their own weakness, which was also picked up on by foreign ambassadors. Which was bad, because France in particular was eager to curb Soviet economic progress. The war scare in Europe in the spring of 1930 had also been preceded by French authorities discovering small caches of weapons in northern Indochina, apparently supplied through the Comintern in Moscow in late 1929. Aggressive communist support for an uprising in North Vietnam in February 1930 was yet another example of early exuberance on the world stage getting the better of long-term good sense. The already conservative anti-communist French government became a staunch enemy after that. But instead of going in on the Soviets militarily, they instead sought to curtail them economically. With French encouragement, the small states of Central Europe began floating ideas of economic coordination, if not union, with an eye towards closing off markets for cheap Soviet grain and minerals. Our old friend, the French Foreign Minister Briand, increased his agitation for a European Federation, not just to settle the running disputes between France and Germany, but to present a united front against the USSR as well. Keep in mind, too, that this is in the early stage of the Depression, where France was actually doing pretty well for itself and could present itself as a continent-wide leader with a straight face. Unity of action between the states of Europe was far more dangerous to the USSR than an economic Cold War with France alone. France constituting only around 4% of all Soviet trade versus, say, Germany's 22%. The French government had been adamant in telling its domestic companies that if they did business with the Soviets, bad things were likely to happen to them. This was backed up in March 1930 when Soviet firms operating in France were seized and their assets used to pay down on some of the Tsarist-era loan debts that had formed the poisoned roots of the two countries' relations from day one. Little side note, the Industrial Party trial that I mentioned a couple weeks ago was also happening around this time, and part of the accusations against the economic planners was that they were working at the direction of the French. By the autumn of 1930, the capitals of Central Europe were considering increased tariffs or outright embargoes on Soviet imports. While individually these nations didn't count for much in the grand scheme of Soviet foreign trade, a functioning bloc of all of them together under France would present both an economic inconvenience and a diplomatic cordon. With relations with the Germans declining, as I'll discuss in a moment, Litvinov was left to pursue any available option to keep the Soviets from being cordoned off from Europe. This resulted in a long-term flirtation with fascist Italy of all places, and despite the relative indifference between the two nations, Italy's Foreign Department agreed to back the Soviets, joining the Special European Commission of the League of Nations that provided a forum on relations in the continent in May 1932. They were allowed in conditionally, the USSR not actually being a member of the League, and their participation was confined to discussing economic matters. It was not a full victory by any means, but did get the USSR recognized as at least a tangential part of the formal diplomatic world. Remember, this was still a time when, for example, the US still had not recognized the Soviet government at all, and this was the case all over the world as well. Getting even backhanded recognition was still recognition. And moreover, that meant since they were part of the diplomatic order, certain powers could not expect to plan against them on the basis of them being outsiders. And in case you're curious what the Italians got out of this sponsor relationship, it was basically just a demonstration that they were a great power and that they could make moves on the world stage by themselves. The problem of Soviet weakness also revealed that the traditional diplomatic counterweight the Soviets employed, Germany, was not actually going to be a useful partner going into the future. In fact, the 30s would see relations between the two decline, all the while their economic entanglements only increased. Germany was already the USSR's biggest trading partner, and by 1931, that share was set to only get bigger. Notable reasons included Germany's own economy doing so badly that it became a buyer's market there, and another was that the Soviets had initially put a lot of stock in the US for their manufactured goods and equipment. That stock was reduced by 1931 on account of domestic US enterprises, especially the coal miners and farmers, protesting against the Soviets flooding the commodities market, and also because even after the Soviets became reliable customers to the US, the Hoover administration adamantly refused to provide diplomatic recognition. So, the Soviets took their ball and went to Germany. Fun side note, that economic pressure actually worked in getting some changes made in the US. When FDR took office in 1933, he was pressed by the business community and members of his own party to recognize the USSR. FDR needed little encouragement, as he correctly saw Hitler as the larger threat to world peace even in 1933, and on November 16th of that year provided official recognition. Anyway, there was the sense that if the Soviets put enough money into Germany, that their interests would be safeguarded despite strained relations. That was a bad calculation and blew up in their faces after the rise of the Nazis, but it was a hope. The logic was put succinctly, either the Germans took the money and worked with the Soviets, or their economy would further spiral and more industrial workers would join with the KPD. Take your pick. The biggest threat for the USSR on its western border was Poland, and Germany was helpfully anti-Polish on account of border disputes that we are all familiar with by now and will be revisiting this season. The thing was, though, that the effects of the Depression had crushed Germany's economy too badly, and suddenly territorial revanchism was not the highest priority. Relations between Germany and Poland therefore improved, as both lowered their economic guards to one another. And if the switch in policy under German Chancellor Brüning was bad, his downfall would actually make relations worse. The political rise of Franz von Papen brought to the fore an ardent anti-communist, giving expression to the preferences of President Hindenburg. In 1931, even before he had entered the national-level political scene, Papen had used his network of social, political, and business contacts to advocate for an economic alliance with France and Poland, with the intent on economically stunting the first five-year plan as much as they possibly could, something the Soviets took bitter note of. Papen would go so far as pitching an anti-Soviet military alliance with France during the summer 1932 Lausanne Conference. Economic ties might have continued to hum right along, with the German government offering loans to the USSR in order to buy German goods and even unused factory equipment, but the diplomatic front worsened by the day, and this was before the Nazis had even risen to power. Once Hitler actually did come to power in January 1933, and especially after the Enabling Act passed after the Reichstag fire, relations between the two countries were basically put on ice, and suddenly the Soviet Union was well and truly on its own diplomatically, without even a fair-weather friend. While both nations publicly insisted that domestic policies would not harm relations, both sniped at each other. The Nazis would harass branches of Soviet oil groups doing business in Germany. The Soviets would shut down agricultural leases the Germans had been operating within the USSR. The under-the-table military and political cooperation between the two countries was understandably wound down. And just as a sidebar, the Soviet response to the rise of the Nazis can be summed up in one word: cope. When the Nazis were coming up in their elections, newspapers in the USSR would talk about a split between the NSDAP and the bourgeois parties, which ignored the reality that it was the bourgeois parties that completely collapsed in the early 30s and quickly became irrelevant. That the Soviets conjectured that these bourgeois parties would be meaningfully backed by the French was doubly delusional. Then there was the forbidding the KPD from allying with the SPD in the years before 1933, the objective of which was to ensure maximum chaos in Germany. Objective achieved, I guess. Real shame about how maximum chaos turned out. The attitude from Stalin and pretty much the rest of the inner circle was that Hitler was a mediocrity who could not possibly govern Germany in the midst of the Depression. The only ones taking the threat seriously from the start were Litvinov and the Foreign Affairs Commissariat. By the time the leadership realized Hitler was for real, the Nazis had solidified their power and both the KPD and SPD had been dismantled. Admittedly, there probably wasn't a lot the Soviets could do, even if they told the KPD to throw in with the SPD from the get-go. Everyone else in Germany outside of those two parties already lumped them together anyway, so it wouldn't have been like that would have, you know, expanded their base of support. And the SPD would have never been cooperative with the Comintern anyway. And a lot of other foreign observers also misread the German situation, some even worse than Stalin did. But the fact remains that the Nazis were badly underestimated by Stalin and the other Soviet leaders. And that while the Great Depression gave the Soviets plenty of breathing room to execute the first five-year plan, it also gave their mortal enemies the window they needed to secure power as well. Litvinov did try and reach some kind of détente with the French as the Nazis steadily gained in the polls during the early 1930s, but the French government remained too divided to commit even to a non-aggression pact, much less actual cooperation. It would be well into the 30s and after German rearmament was in full swing that the French even began to seriously consider offers from the Soviets. In Europe, diplomacy would continue at about the same clip. The Soviets were always trying to find an in with somebody, but everybody else kind of rejecting their overtures. At least in Europe, they could actually conduct diplomacy, though. In the Far East, relations were so hostile that military buildups, war scares, and border skirmishes were a fact of life. The Kuomintang's warlord proxy, Zheng Xueliang, might have been soundly beaten in late 1929, during the border war between the Soviets and China, but his exposed weakness was of course pounced upon by the Japanese. In September 1931, the Mukden Incident occurred, Japanese troops entered Manchuria, and the balance of power in the region was badly destabilized. While the Japanese for the moment respected the Soviet hold on the Chinese Eastern Railway running through northern Manchuria, the Red Army rushed in reinforcements to the Far East with the expectation that another expedition would have to be launched. The prospect of that would be dicey because there were only so many troops that could be deployed to the Far East, on account of the Trans-Siberian Railway being of limited size and also because it was running at max capacity before the buildup, and that meant that troops had to be supplied with food provisioned locally. And that put a strain on the whole region, bad enough that the collectivization drive there was rolled back to encourage farmers to be more productive in order to feed the incoming soldiers. There was a terrible fear that the Japanese might continue their advance northwards into Soviet territory. While again, in retrospect, this was implausible, keep in mind that the Japanese army was rabidly anti-Soviet and many prominent officers openly advocated to invade the Soviet Far East and Siberia. Red Army commanders were not bullish on a military outcome and pressed for foreign allies to corral the Japanese. The most obvious partner in the Far East were the Americans, given that they had natural hostility with the Japanese. The problem was that the Hoover administration had no love of the Soviets and little interest in getting involved. This changed a great deal when FDR gained the presidency, but even then, events moved slowly. U.S. recognition of the USSR only arrived in November 1933, and by the time diplomats were sitting down together to discuss a united response to Japan, that empire had already been in Manchuria for over 2.5 years, and the threat of war had largely passed. The UK's attitude was even worse, as they actively delighted in the idea of a second Russo-Japanese war. Eventually, Stalin would bring himself to support Chiang Kai-shek and the KMT once again, but that would only come later and after Chiang had made a detente with the CPC. Without foreign support, the Soviets contented themselves with supporting Manchurian partisans and communist agitators in China. In 1935, Moscow sold its controlling interest in the Chinese Eastern Railway to the Japanese, just to be rid of that little bit of awkwardness. Manchukuo might have been a puppet state, but its master was not liable to be dictated to like the Kuomintang government had been. While many in both the Soviet Union and Japan expected the two to go to war at any time, China turned out to be a much bigger project than the Japanese expected. Instead of marching onwards to Chita and Lake Baikal, the Japanese found themselves furiously investing into Manchuria, all the while trying to get their own house in order in the years following the invasion. And with the Kuomintang government now implacably hostile to the Japanese, it steadily became clear that they might have overcommitted. By the mid-30s, the Soviets could comfort themselves that war in the Far East was off the table, for them. And that was kind of the best that Soviet diplomacy could expect during the first half of the 30s. Without the boons of industrialization fully in place just yet, they simply were not in full control of their own destiny. The USSR was simply too large to be tangled with lightly, but too wrapped up in its own domestic turmoil to directly challenge the global capitalist order. But the achievements of the first five-year plan were to prove transformational in how the USSR conducted itself in its relations, which does mean that foreign affairs will be a much bigger topic later in the season. As the world fell to pieces, the increasingly mechanized Red Army became an instrument of war that couldn't be ignored, and forced the other powers to engage with Moscow, if only to make sure they weren't an active threat. Not that the USSR really made any friends along the way. The other big theme of Soviet diplomacy, in addition to enhanced relevance later on, was that other nations still didn't want to be their friends. And that brings me to the end of my coverage for the first five-year plan, and for now, we are done with the Soviets. I've spent a lot of time with this series talking about how big and how important all these changes were, so I feel like I don't need to agonize over a detailed recap on what I've covered. If you need to carry any broad ideas away from these past 12 episodes, let it be 1. The first five-year plan gave the USSR the capability to meet its own material needs in a self-sustaining fashion, meaning that if they were suddenly and catastrophically thrust into a life-or-death conflict, their own resources were capable of protecting the nation and keeping society functioning. Maybe not perfectly, but it was at least possible. 2, state power was enhanced across the entire USSR, oftentimes not in a positive way, but the end result was a far more solid entity than what had ever existed, which, yeah, important for a potential life-or-death conflict. And finally, 3, it created a break with the past that couldn't be retreated from. This kind of overlaps with Idea 2, and that's fine. The patterns of life in the USSR changed forever. It wasn't just work that changed. People's entire ways of life changed. Despite the dislocations, famines, and simple scramble for survival, the Soviet Union became a much more communal nation. There was a sense that they were in it together, because they were. There was a stronger sense of shared identity and purpose, which, yes, was very handy for later. If the rise of the Nazis was the most dramatic political change of the season, then these years within the Soviet Union represent the most dramatic economic and social changes. And as the first five-year plan nomenclature suggests, the work wasn't over. Well, it was never going to be over, that was kind of built in. But when I return to the Soviet Union later this season, the second five-year plan won't be the primary focus. I'll touch on it, certainly, but it won't be the fixation. The reason for that is because this first plan was such a game-changer. The work of these years completely transformed the Soviet Union in ways that the following plans simply didn't. The work that came later was iterative, building upon what worked previously or trying to fix what didn't. So instead, look forward to the Great Purge when I next return to the Union. If you have been curious why I haven't touched on, you know, things like the secret police or the gulags, I'm lumping it all into that series, which I'm sure will be a pleasure for all of you to listen to. I'm already preparing my psyche to endure producing those episodes. But in the meantime, I'm moving on to slightly easier, breezier material. I opened the season with the United States in the early Depression, and we're going back there to cover the first 2 years of the New Deal. Yep, just the first 2 years. There is going to be a lot of United States content this season, just a heads up. And to kick things off, I'll be starting with the only biography series of this season, a two-parter introducing good ol' Franklin Delano Roosevelt, an American aristocrat who became an unlikely champion of state power in a nation where that was considered a terrible sin. So, join me next week for that, and as always, thank you very much for listening.